So last week we talked about being subject to one another, being a servant, verse 21, and putting the sacrifice and making it it's not for the benefit of us, okay? And so one thing that we're going to look at here, we're in Ephesians 5, and we're going to start in verse 22. One thing I want to point out is that last week we went to verse 21, and this week we're going to verse 22. We're probably going to continue on, okay? So the point is that it's one of my pet peeves is when people start going back and being like, don't worry, we're going to get on to husbands next time, okay? I think that...
You don't have...
That's right. Well, it's going to be 2 weeks, so the women are going to sit with this for 2 weeks before the husbands get there. The point is that we're going to talk about today, no matter what the issue is, we're obligated to do our job versus complain about the other person not doing theirs. But we're going to start in Daniel chapter 1 today. Daniel chapter 1. And there's actually going to be a good amount of reading today. So if you get a passage and it's big, go ahead and take it because the next one might be bigger. So Daniel chapter 1, we're going to read from verse 8. Through verse 21.
But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink, for why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the presence of the youths who are eating the king's choice, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables. And as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then, at the end of the days which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king.
Okay, so it seems not really on the topic of what we're looking at today, except for the fact that Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were left with the choice of to eat the king's food like the other Jewish youth that were with them, or not to. A point we need to understand is that it didn't make it right for them to eat the king's food because the other ones weren't doing what was right either. And we see by the end that God worked out their obedience. I mean, he worked it out because they were obedient. He made it. It might have been a while, but he made it. He made it for them. He helped them accomplish, and he exalted them, I guess you would say. Let's turn to a couple chapters over to Daniel 3. So Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, are also known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay, and that's the Babylonian names that they were given. Someone in Daniel chapter 3, see here, someone want to read, let me see, make sure my notes are right. Okay, yeah, down in chapter 3, verse 12 through 17.
There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image that I have set up. Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the flute, lyre, trident, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made very well. But if you will not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what god is there who can deliver you out of my hand? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace, the blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king.
Verse 18, too, man.
But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the gold image that you have set up.
Okay, so we can mostly know the end of the story, or all of us do, that obviously they didn't die. But notice it didn't make it right for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to bow down just because everybody else is doing it. Okay? And it also didn't make it right for them to even to disobey God, even if it was, we'll use the term, unjust, even if the king was unreasonable or wicked. Okay, so it didn't make it right for them to let their obligation go, to the commitment they made to God, just because of even death. Okay, so let's turn back to Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5. I want to read 22 through 24, please.
Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything.
Okay, so the question that we can have is how much authority does the church serve over Christ? Or how submissive is the church to Christ? So if we're comparing that, the obvious answer is that there's no authority served over Christ, and they are completely submissive. So if we're looking at that, and we're looking at the idea in comparing the wife to the husband. See, Paul isn't, as we'll get to when we get to the end of the chapter, Paul is really talking about the church and Christ and the church anyway. But he is using the example of Christ and the church as what the husband and wife example should be, what the husband and wife should look like. And he is saying there that the church is subject. So if you take verse 22 through 24 and you read and you take out wives and you read the church, and then you go do it again, and you take out the word church, and you read wives. You could be this to be the same thing. That's what he's saying there. Just as the wife, or the church is subject to Christ, the wife is subject to Christ, her husband in everything. Now, that word for subject there means to place or to rank under, or to subject oneself. Okay? And granted, this is a choice. It can't be something, it's not, we're not going to be successful. Just like we talked last week about being subject, it's not successful if we do it begrudgingly. It's only successful if we make up in our mind to choose to serve one another. And so this word here, again, the church is subject to Christ. We're not successful as Christians if we aren't voluntarily subject to Christ. It's not by fear or by law that we have to be subject and we're made to be subject to Christ, but it's by voluntary. And so the same thing with the wife being subject to the husband in a few things. Scratch it. In everything, it says. It doesn't say when your husband's the easy husband. It doesn't say, you know, the phrase I've heard, you know, and I've heard it probably both ways it can be applied, is that it, you know, the spouse is easy to live with if the spouse is if a spouse is easy to live with, it's an easy marriage. Okay, or a phrase I've heard is that a husband is easy to be submissive to if he's a good husband. Well, that's kind of an obvious question or answer there. I mean, yeah, the husband is easy to be submissive to if the husband's a good husband. Okay? But the time is that the problem is, or not the problem, the thing is that the obligation of being submissive to the husband isn't dependent on whether the husband's a good husband or not. Okay, if the husband is a bad husband for a time, or does something wrong, the wife is still supposed to be submissive. I mean, it didn't make Daniel, it give him any more obligation or any more out to not be obedient to God because it was difficult, because everybody else was doing it, because it would have been easier to do it that way. It didn't give Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego right to take their obligation and commitment to God to erase that because there was a trial. Let's turn over to Colossians chapter 3. Colossians 3, verse 18. So the word for subject, again, there is used. And the word for fitting, that word means it is due or it is befitting, or it's translated, it's used three times in the New Testament, it's translated proper at another time. We'll look at that in a second. But so he's saying there, wives, be subject to your husbands, it is due in the Lord. It is befitting, it is proper in the Lord. Now that word for due is used over, or for fitting, as it's translated in New American Standard. It's used over in Philemon chapter 1. And Philemon is a really small book because it's only one chapter and it's about one page. So right after Titus, right before Hebrews. Now this is an interesting, we're going to bring this point up a little bit later too. But this, Paul is writing a letter to Philemon, who is a master of a slave, Onesimus. And Onesimus had fled, and he met up with Paul. And so Paul is talking to him in a master-slave relationship, because this will come up a little bit later too. Okay, but in verse 8, so I want to read of that in Philemon chapter 1. Okay, so that word for proper there, he is talking to Philemon and writing to Philemon, so that it and saying that I have boldness or confidence to order you that you do what is proper. So Philemon, Paul is talking about him doing something proper, doing something right, doing something correct. That's the same word when it's saying, wives, be subject to your husband. That is proper. That is correct. That is right. It doesn't, on the other hand, it is improper if a wife is not subject to her husband. It's improper. Let's look at a couple examples, because it's easy to go and say this and that, but let's look at actually some examples, because a lot of times what will go is that there'll be, when we talk about women in authority, or the topic of women leading their husbands, or women in authority, even in the church sometimes, what is one answer that's always there, one backlash to that, about like women preaching, for example, what is one argument that's used? Well, that's one too. What's another one?
Or why they do it?
Yeah, like what's an excuse or a reason why that they'll give for a woman to have an authority?
Because God gave her the ability.
Okay, that's not the one I'm looking for. But
they're fine. Tell us right.
How about what about Ruth? She wrote a book, right?
Yeah.
What about Esther? She was a queen, right? So let's go look at Ruth 3. So it's all they'll look at. Well, there is women in the Bible that have had been recognized, that they'll call authority, but in the Old Testament, in Ruth, right after Judges, right before 1 Samuel, and we're not going to go through the whole book, so kind of just a little. Foundation here. So Ruth was a Moabite woman, and Naomi was her mother-in-law, and they had another. Naomi had two sons, and it comes down the line that Naomi's wife her husband dies, and Naomi's two sons die that were married. They had daughters, and one daughter went back to her country, but Ruth stayed with Naomi because Naomi was going back. She was a Jew, and she's going back to Israel. Okay, so Naomi, the custom in Israel was as if a wife or a husband died, that his brother was supposed to raise up kin to his name, was to marry his wife. And so, and sometimes when that, you know, obviously that guy's brother died as well. Okay, so she's going back to Israel now, and so usually it would be the closest relative. Okay, and so that's kind of some background. So Ruth goes and we're going to be in Ruth chapter 3. Ruth goes and she another custom in Israel was that they didn't completely glean all the fields when they harvest. They left some of the corners and stuff like that. They would leave for the widows and the orphans or the poor, those who didn't have, they could come and pick off the fields, and that was a custom, okay? So Ruth is going here, and she's gleaning Boaz's field and Boaz recognizes her, and Boaz knows her because he's a close relative, okay? He's a close relative to Naomi. And so in Ruth chapter 3, we're going to pick it up in verse 7. Now, note here that Boaz and Ruth, he's already talked to Ruth, and he's already said, go ahead and glean the field and everything, and he's talked to his servants about her. And so we're going to read in verse 7 through 12, please.
When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." How many to what? Verse 12.
Verse 12.
Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my God, and my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask for all my people in the city know
that you are a woman of excellence. And now it is true I am a close relative, however, there is a relative closer than I.
Okay, so just to kind of finish up the story, that he goes and talks to those in the city, and there is a close relative, and that relative doesn't take Ruth as his wife. So then Boaz, he and what it was is he bought the field, and then he had Ruth as his wife through that. And so the closer relative didn't do that, and so Boaz was the one who did that. And then you get later on in the book of Ruth that they have a child named Obed, who is the father of Jesse, who is the father of David, and so on. But the point I want to make here is that Ruth could have went after younger men. Obviously, Boaz is an older guy here, okay? And she would have been older. She could have went after younger men. She could have, when he says your kindness, your last kindness is better than the first by not going after younger men, she could have went after anybody. And really, Ruth wasn't a Jew. She was a Moabite. But she was committed to her mother-in-law, Naomi, because the other daughter-in-law went back to her father's house in Moab or wherever it was. And Ruth didn't. Ruth was committed, and she stuck with Naomi, and she was rewarded. Now notice that Ruth, Boaz eventually took Ruth as his wife, and Ruth found favor, not because of the authority that she had, not because of the great thing that she did, except for the kindness and submissiveness that she showed. Okay, it was something that you think of Ruth, and people talk about Ruth and the great woman she was, and that's why they need, you know, maybe women should have authority, because God held those women special. Well, the reason he held her special is because she was kind and submissive. That was what was great about Ruth. It wasn't that she went and was like, you know, and demanded that Boaz marry her and bring up offspring for her. It was that she was submissive and kind. That's why she was considered a great woman. That's why she has a book. It wasn't because of some authority that she muscled around. Let's turn to Esther. Esther chapter 7. Esther chapter 7, and there's a lot of things here that we're not going to cover again. Esther, at the beginning of the book, I guess the king of Persia, him and his wife, we'll just call it, they had a little bit of a mishap and a disagreement, and so she was no longer his wife, and so then he brought up a lot of the young women to find a new queen, and Mordecai, who was a Jew, had his cousin Esther go to be in this, I don't know if you want to call it some beauty pageant is what it was, but to be amongst these young women so that she could be king or queen, and eventually we see that she saves her people. Haman hates Mordecai. Haman is a Persian who hates Mordecai, and he wants to kill the Jews. Mordecai, if you read the book, he helps and brings awareness to an assassination on the king, and so the king props up Mordecai. In Esther 7, we get to the point after a little bit where Haman is ready to hang Mordecai, and he's building the gallows, and it's pleasing to him. And Esther, prior to this, brings a banquet, or makes a banquet for Esther, or for the king, and for Haman, and Haman is excited about it, okay? And he's wicked, obviously. Now, Esther, if you know about, like, how ancient kings worked, I mean, the queen had, at times, had authority. We have, you know, king, queenism in England and stuff like that. But in this case, it wasn't just that Esther could throw authority around, even though she was queen. Notice what in verse 1 through 6 of Esther chapter 7. So I want to read that, please.
Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther and the queen. also as they drank their wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom shall it be done. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as many as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. Then King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he? Who would presume to do thus? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen.
Okay, so eventually we see that in verse 7, the king is angry, rose and was angry, and then Haman is hanged in verse 10. From the gallows, which he prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Okay, so Esther, and she had an opportunity here as well to have up to half the kingdom. Okay, because that's what he offered her. What's your request? Because she had prepared a banquet before, and then she prepared a meal again. She had a plea here again, and she has the opportunity to have half the kingdom. But she goes and she says and she explains to the king what is going to happen or what is planned to happen. See, she didn't go and write a decree and take the authority and hang Haman herself. I mean, you think a queen would have that authority. I mean, she could have tried that route. But she went being submissive as a wife to her husband, laying it out, and helping him make the right decision. Because Haman was on the other side trying to get him to do the opposite. And so when she, the reason that I mean, I'm not saying that this is the only reason that Ruth and Esther have books, but the reason that they're the kind of women they were was because they were submissive. That's the reason. That's the reason you read about them. Because they were submissive. I mean, there's reasons we read about, as we'll go here in a second, we read about a queen that is written about but wasn't submissive. We'll go to that in a second here. But that's why we have Esther and Ruth. That's why we read about them and we see that they were successful, not because of their authority, not because they jockeyed for position, Esther at least had the opportunity to, but she was great because of her submissiveness. She was great because of how her character was. And as in Ruth's case and as in Esther's case, they were we'll just call it wife material, because they were wanting to help. They wanted to help the husband instead of serving the authority over him and demanding it from him. Okay, 'cause she couldn't demand it. The only way she was going to be successful, I mean, if she went and demanded it, she would have been killed. If you read the first part of the book, that's probably a little bit of a reason why we have the first part of the book of Esther in there, is when the first queen didn't do what the king said, and he got rid of her. So it wasn't outside the kings of the king here to do that, and Esther won him over because of submissiveness. Let's turn to 1 Kings. Chapter 16. Any guesses of this queen? Let's turn 1 Kings 16, 29 through 33.
Now Ahab, son of Omri, became king over Israel in the 38th year. Asa, king of Judah, and Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. He came came about as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidons, went to serve Baal and worshiped him. So he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel that were before him. In his days, Baal, the Bethlehemite, built Jericho. He laid its foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up his gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun.
Okay. So we see here that Ahab, I mentioned it before, and this is again when the northern kingdom and southern kingdom. Okay. So Ahab is now king of the northern kingdom, and Asa is the king of the southern kingdom, Judah. And it was trivial for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam that he married Jezebel. Okay, so he went and married Jezebel, a Sidonite, who served Baal and worshipped him. And then so then he erected the altar, and we see that. Let's turn over to 1 Kings 21. So we see that Jezebel, as a queen, and we know that she's wicked. We know that we see here that there's the false gods brought in there. But we see here in 1 Kings 21, we're going to read about something that she did, or how she encouraged her husband. We see that Esther, before, she encouraged her husband with something. You know, she encouraged her husband and brought something before him. Ruth, in a way, she is acting in a way of submissiveness and how she is winning over her future husband, if you will. We're going to see how Jezebel, how her wickedness and how what that makes happen here in chapter 21, 1 through 16.
Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, "Give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is close beside my house, and I will give you a better vineyard than in it in your place. If you like, I will give you the price of it in money." But Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid me that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." So Ahab came into his house sullen and vexed because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." He lay down in his bed and turned away his face and ate no food. But Jezebel's wife came to him and said to him, "How is it that your spirit is so sullen that you are not eating food?" So he said to her, "Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite, and he said to him, 'Give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it pleases you, I will give you a vineyard in its place.' But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.' Jezebel, his wife, said to him, 'Do you now reign over Israel? Arise, eat bread, and let your heart be joyful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite.' So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent letters to the elders and to the nobles who were living with Naboth in his city. Now she wrote in the letters saying, 'Proclaim a fast and seat Naboth at the head of the table, at the head of the people, and seat two worthless men before him and let them testify against him, saying, "You curse God and the king, then take him out and stone him to death." So the men of his city, the elders and the nobles who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, just as it was written in the letters which she had sent them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth at the head of the people. Then the two worthless men came in and sat before him, and the worthless men testified against him, even against Naboth, before the people, saying, "Naboth cursed God and the king." So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent word to Jezebel, saying, "Naboth has been stoned and is dead." When Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead." When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it.
Yeah. So Jezebel, the wicked queen, took and muscled her authority around to create lies and bring a council together to get it where Naboth was accused falsely to be stoned and put to death so that her husband would get what he wanted, his heart's desire. So you see a wicked wife and how she is going about and arranging things for the purpose. And if you read the end of the story of Ahab, Jezebel falls out of a roof, and all that's left after the dogs get through with her is her hands, and Ahab gets killed in battle. Okay, and so the worst king of Israel, at least worse than all it was before him, married a wicked queen and went straight to death. You know, I mean, obviously it was over a period of time, 28 years or whatever it was, but the worthless wife, the unsubmissive wife, proves to lead her husband to destruction. Now, I'm not saying that he was out, that he had no saying or had no accountability in that. I'm not saying that. But you look at the opposite, you put Ruth and Esther versus Jezebel, and you see the success rate, and you see the even in Esther's case, where you could probably consider King Ahasuerus wicked. You know, he wasn't a Jew. He wasn't, you know, he was going to go forward with Haman's plan to kill all the Jews. I mean, like, did you think that maybe someone would just blink an eye, maybe if going to kill somebody? I mean, like, it was almost like that didn't bother him until Esther brought it before him. And Esther won him and won him over through submissiveness, and Ruth won Boaz over through submissiveness, and Jezebel led Ahab plunge headlong into destruction because she was wicked, because she was muscling her authority. Turn to Proverbs 21. You can find the exact same, or pretty close to it anyway, if not exactly the same words written in Proverbs 5:24, but we're going to read them out of Proverbs 21, verse 9. I say 5:25, I meant Proverbs 25:24. You find this verse as well. But someone read Proverbs 21, verse 9. What chapter are you in, Larry?
Pardon?
What chapter are you in there?
21.
Verse 9? Maybe I said that wrong.
I'm in Psalms.
Oh, okay. That's okay.
Pretty good verse,
huh?
Yeah. It kind of fits.
Proverbs 21, verse 9.
Yes, sir.
It is better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman.
Okay, so you see the same word, verses in Proverbs 25, verse 24. A bad woman will cause a lot of destruction. We see that example with Jezebel. Okay, but a righteous woman, as in Esther and Ruth, you see how that plan and they were exalted and they were successful. Now let's look at another example in 1 Samuel chapter 25. Now this is prior to David. Saul's still alive, And it's prior to David ascending to the throne yet, but he has been anointed king by Samuel. This is actually after Samuel dies. And we see that there is something that takes place. David has been defending this area because the Philistines are also battling Israel during this time while Saul is chasing after David. We're going to start in verse 2 and 3. So I want to read that, please.
1 Samuel 25.
Yes.
2 and 3. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing the sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a celibate.
Okay, so we see here first that we have Nabal and Abigail. Okay, it's referencing that Nabal was a harsh, evil man. Okay, Abigail was an intelligent woman. Okay, so let's turn over a few verses to verse 13, but prior to this, David sends some men to, he hears that Nabal is shearing sheep here, and he has been protecting the area David has, and so he asked him for a favor and for some stuff, for some provisions for a festive day, and so Nabal basically says, "Who are you?" Even though he would have known probably who David was. And basically what he's doing is he's insulting David, and he is treating him like garbage, okay, even though David has protected the land. So in verse 13 through 17, let's pick up there.
And David said to his men, "Each of you gird on your sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and 400 men went up behind David, about 200 stayed with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David has sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the field. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now therefore, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all of our household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him."
Okay, so a servant of Nabal's and Abigail came to Abigail and reported to her the dealings, and David here is going to go and he's going to wipe out Nabal because he scorned David's servants, his disrespect. When David was protecting him, the servant referenced there, they guarded night and day while we were tending sheep. David was protecting the area, and Nabal cursed him, basically. So now in verse 18 through 38.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's a pretty long read, but one thing I think that we need to see, so Abigail, being the wife of a man who obviously had a lot of possessions, it says he was very rich at the beginning of the in verse 2, okay? And so he had to shear sheep, 3,000 sheep, and he had 3,000 goats or whatever it was there. But he had some a lot of servants. Okay, he was very rich. It would have been an opportunity, you know, a thing that he could have, you know, Abigail could have warned him, and rewarded the wickedness, and they could have went about it by force. But Abigail, when she does what is right, even when the husband is evil, she goes and she stops David from bloodshed and from avenging himself, even though Nabal deserved it, even though it would have been, he was a wicked man, even though it was unreasonable, or he was unreasonable and evil, and most likely he was that way to her, she still, if you want to call it intercedes, she interceded for David, yeah, some, but she was also interceding for her husband. See, God took care of that. See, God took care of the problem. Now, I'm not saying that that happens all the time, but my point is that Abigail didn't meet it with authority. She met it with submissiveness and sacrifice. Okay, and we see it later, David, after Nabal dies, I mean, David does marry Abigail. But he was going to go and wipe out every male, servants and all, of Nabal's. He was going to wipe them all out before Abigail went and interceded. She came and she bowed down. She came and was submissive. She recognized who David was. She said, someday when the Lord puts you on the throne, you know, she understood that. She didn't win him over there because of her authority or her demanding or her strong-willed personality. She won him over because she was submissive. She won him over because she made a sacrifice. That's how she won him over. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. Verse
21 through 25. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth, and while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, that he might die to sin and live, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. For you were continually straying like sheep, but now you have returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls.
Okay, so Jesus, when it was unreasonable, when it was unjust, when he was reviled, he didn't revile in return, but he did what? He kept entrusting himself. He entrusted himself to who was judging righteously. So there's no chapters and verses in the original letter. If you turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1, which is right after what we just read, notice a word there. In the same way, you wives, be submissive. I know that was a few words or whatever. So I want to read chapter 3, 1 through 8, or 1 through 6, please, of 1 Peter.
In the same way, you wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. As they observe your pure contact with fear, your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on garments, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible quality of a lowly and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being subject to their own husbands. Just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, you have become her children if you do good, not fearing any intimidation.
Okay. So, a passage here that has really been taken out of context and has completely missed the big point of it when you talk about like verse 2 verse 3 and 4, and when you know the focus a lot by a lot of people is that and I'm not saying not to dress modestly, but the focus is that how a wife is that she doesn't make herself look pretty at all, no braiding of the hair, no jewelry, no bunch of dresses. In the context, what Peter is talking about there, he is talking about winning the husband over, okay? And he's saying, don't do it in that way. And a term we would use today, the phrase is that the common thought is that a wife gets what she wants by withholding something that the husband wants, or maybe dress in a certain way to win her husband in that way through pleasure or whatever it is, rather than being respectful and submissive. Because here's an example. If a wife does that and that's how she wins her husband, then that's the only way that she wins her husband. And so when that stuff stops, then she no longer has her husband. But if she wins him through being submissive and respectful and gentle, then she has foundation. But if you compare that, because Jesus is the example there, that even though it was unjust, it was unreasonable, even if you go back to verse 18 of 1 Peter chapter 2, notice what it says. It talks about servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only those who are good and gentle, but to those who are unreasonable. And then he goes on and he talks about how Jesus didn't revile when he was reviled. He didn't utter any threats, but he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. He kept entrusting himself to the Father. In the same way, then, wives, be submissive to your own husbands. The way to win a husband, the way to be the character of the wife, and that's why he goes and says in verse 5, in the former times, the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their husbands, being respectful to their husbands, not out of fear. And what that's saying there is that it wasn't, it's not out of fear that the husband is frightened. That's not how someone is submissive. But it doesn't mean just because a husband is unreasonable that the wife should be submissive. What he's really saying then, and let's just put this in a little bit of context here, if the husband is unreasonable and demanding the wife to be submissive, and the wife is submissive because of that fear, and that's the only reason she's submissive, then that's not working either, even though she's been submissive and maybe she chooses a doormat. Okay, that's not how it is, but it doesn't mean that he's saying that they shouldn't still be submissive. He is saying that the wives need to be submissive because they're voluntarily doing that. because they're trying to win their husband. They're being respectful to their husband. It isn't because the husband's a jerk that they're submissive. They're submissive because that's what the holy women of old were. They didn't adorn themselves. They didn't win their husbands through the fancy clothing. They won their husbands because they were submissive. Jesus wasn't successful because he stopped it. He was successful because even though it was unjust, he kept entrusting himself to the one who judges righteously. And the wives are the same way. You could do the same thing with the slaves. Even though they're unreasonable, you're not supposed to be submissive and respectful to the good masters only, but even the ones who are unreasonable. It doesn't, whether you look at Daniel or Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, or a slave or a wife, and as we'll see next time, a husband, it doesn't give us the right to not do what we should do because of unreasonable circumstances. That's not the out. Of course it's a lot easier to be submissive to a good husband. That's like a no-duh comment. Of course it's a lot easier. But it does not mean that, I mean, would have been easier for why wouldn't Abigail just let David come and take care of business? Because she didn't know that God was going to take away Nabal. She was doing that thinking that she was going to live the rest of her life with this wicked, evil man. But she still did it. Because even though it was unreasonable, even though he was unjust, even though he was wicked, she still was submissive. Even though Esther could have been killed, how she handled that could have determined whether she was killed or not. She was submissive. Ruth, not knowing if she'd ever get married again, was submissive to Naomi and followed after her and was obedient to Naomi. And she didn't win Boaz over because it was Boaz's right or obligation. She won Boaz over because she was submissive. Because she was kind. And compare that to Jezebel. See, the example of the submissive wife is in the scripture of some great women. And they didn't win by authority. They didn't win by demanding. They didn't win by being rude or mean to their husbands. They won because of submissiveness. They won because they were respectful. They won because they were kind, as opposed to the contentious woman, to the wicked woman, Jezebel, who was ultimately unsuccessful, and so was her husband, because of how she was. Because of her influence. Now, again, that doesn't mean that Ahab didn't have any accountability there. Ahab was wicked too, but she sure didn't help him. So the response is true. Our response and our duty doesn't change because someone else is unjust. Anybody have any comments?
Seen all the examples that we look at in the Old Testament, ladies that the ones that were submissive and did what, based on, were godly women, but they acted as God wanted them to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, great things came from all that.
Right. Right.
I mean, from Esther and from Ruth, and mm-hmm. It was kind of an incredible things came out of that. And
right.
The ones that were destructive, just death.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the fault was.
Right. Yeah.
So, that just is a broad summary of what can happen on both sides of that, I guess. So.
Right. It didn't come the next day either.
No.
You
said it wasn't always just either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would have been more just had Abigail just let David come and just wipe him out.
Yeah.
Because that's what the guy deserved. So.
Right. Yeah.
Like I said, she didn't do that. She spared his life.
Right. Right.
But in the end, she still prospered from that.
Right.
Good things came out of it.
And so if you look at that too, like you compare both the righteous and the wicked woman, and you compare it to how Jesus talks about the church there, and what does he say is that you know, the those who have the pleasure now have their reward, but their destruction happens late at the end. But those who don't have the pleasure now, those who don't have the, you know, like Lazarus, for example, he didn't have all the fancy stuff, you know, the rich man did. And then Lazarus was being comforted and the rich man was in torment. So you see that with Jezebel, she had her run. She had her glory. She had the reward that she had, and she ended up, you know, away from God for eternity in hell is what's happening. And where Ruth and Abigail and Esther, you know, they didn't have it all right then. They had to work for it. They had to do their part in accomplishing that, and then God eventually rewarded them. Eventually the reward came, which would be comparable to the church, where we don't have everything. It's not all just great now, when you think of suffering and think of sacrificing, but in the end, the reward's coming. You know, God eventually works that out. It's not always tomorrow. It's not always next week. It's a lot of times it takes time. And so that's where the example of the church being persevering and being submissive to our husband is an example for the physical marriage, where the wife is submissive and God works that out. Okay? And that's an example there.
Yeah, and so this is comparable in that sense very much is that kind of the overall point of your class really in some ways had little to do with women,
mm-hmm.
and but more so had to do with your job, mm-hmm. or to what you're supposed to be
yeah.
doing. And so in that part of it, it reminded me of Marshall Harper's message some this weekend,
mm-hmm.
Where he was talking about the Great Commission and how, you know, even in hard times and rough times or whatever's happening or whatever, the commission doesn't change. You're still supposed to fulfill that part. As Christians, I mean, submissive to God, into Christ in this, just because persecution comes doesn't mean that we can quit being Christians.
Right.
And so as wives being subject to their husbands, just because the husband doesn't do his spot all the time, or maybe he's even bad like this guy was, if that's something they've committed to doing, they need to commit to doing that, right? But it's not necessarily the submissiveness to the bad husband there was not necessarily for the purpose of being submissive to the bad husband, but it was actually much more had to do with the character of the wife,
right,
than anything. And in the sense of her being submissive to her husband, it was the same as her being submissive to Christ,
right,
or
right.
to God. So, it's not, you know, sometimes, and then the same, you know, because we know people who's, you know, everybody know has, you know, four or five couple friends or whatever they go to different, you know, your mind goes to with some of these examples, whether good or bad, and you think about those, and you know, if you continue to do your job, and in what you're supposed to be doing, you know, worst case scenario, you're found righteous in the eyes of God. You know, maybe it doesn't get better on earth, but at the same time, maybe you win the husband over. Maybe you win the wife
yeah.
over by treating her correctly. Maybe you win the friend over by being nice to them. Maybe you win the enemy over by doing kind things, you know. So, and if you take out even that part of it and just the idea of what you're supposed to be doing, good will come out of that eventually one way or another.
Yeah.
yeah. But, I mean, luckily, I've got a super submissive wife, and she's pretty awesome. So.
Like Marshall Harper's message, what he said there, another thing he said too, it kind of reminded me when you said that, is that he made the point of, are we always trying to find something wrong with something? And that attitude has to be absent from like in Abigail's case, we'll just use, okay? She had every reason to find something wrong with Nabal. But if she would have had that as the focus, then she wouldn't have went and interceded for David. You know, and if we have, and then that's obviously not just a wife thing, but it's a Christian thing as well. Is that if we're continually looking for something to be wrong, we're going to be able to find something that's wrong, because we're going to hear, a lot of times we hear what we want to hear, you know. And so if that's in our lives in general, but especially in a wife's circumstance, we'll say, if that happens, then in Abigail's, then she doesn't intercede for David, or for David or for Nabal. She doesn't go intercede there to stop a bad thing from happening, because she is trying to help the situation instead of always looking for something to be wrong.
So I'm going to just throw out what you're going to hear, what you would hear if there was more liberal ladies here.
Sure.
What about the wife who has a husband that wants her to do bad things, like go steal food, or if he beats her if she doesn't do what he wants her to do? And, you know, I know that you're going to hear that kind of stuff.
Right.
Subject to the king as the way they would be.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the wording, but they stayed within their commitment to God,
right,
and their servant to the king.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a line that can be drawn.
Being submissive is not necessarily going and robbing a bank for the husband. That's not what it's talking about, but it's talking about still being submissive as a wife to try and win him over.
And I'm sure you're going to deal with the wife beaters in your part in 2 weeks when you're talking about
right.
Cousins. But anyway, that's just something that always comes up from
that, yeah.
Women that are...
There's always the extreme example,
yeah.
Just like abortion, there's always the extreme example to justify the not extreme example. Yeah.
Well, I think Paul talks about that a little bit in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 about, you know, he's going to become a Greek to the Greeks,
mm-hmm.
a Jew to the Jews, and a slave to the slave, and
mm-hmm.
because he wants to be submissive to them to win them. And I
right.
think that's the same purpose of what you know, obviously in Peter talked about it. The reason why people. You want to bring the best out of your husband if you're a wife.
Right.
Be submissive, and I think that's what to win them.
Yeah.
What even maybe if they are Christians, it makes them better. You know? I mean that's just what happens with every relationship. Is
right.
You want to be do your part to make them better, and that's
right.
the part you should do.
And that kind of even answers like the question Mom brought up too about Paul.
Yeah.
You know, when you said about Paul there, is that Paul was the Greek to the Greeks, the Jew to the Jews, the slave to the slave, but he didn't drink with the Greeks. He
yeah.
didn't do be a legalist like the Jew.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't abuse a slave like the master, like that. Like he went in the parameters of righteousness still,
yeah.
but he still was trying. He was subject to them and sacrificing to try and win them over.
Jesus asks a question, you know, when they give him the coin, and or when he asks for the coin, they ask, you know, should pay tax, whatever. He says, render to Caesar what is Caesar's, but render to God what is God's.
Yeah.
And the idea is to do whatever you can for Caesar so that he leaves you alone, but make sure that you're doing to God what God requires.
First. Yeah.
And so in the submissiveness, if you're submissive, if what is being told to do is against something that makes you so you're not submissive to God, then it's not necessarily being submissive.
Yeah.
So there's a balance there as well.
Right. And I think one thing that it might be a little bit gray there is that submissive still doesn't mean obedient as a slave completely. And so it's not that the wife isn't being submissive if she doesn't go rob the bank. She can still be submissive and not go rob the bank for the husband if he asks her to do that. You know, and so... So he is just like with, you know, I mean, there's obviously the extreme example there. I mean, if you could compare that to, eventually Caesar's going to ask for your head if you don't deny Jesus. But you know, I mean, that would be, you know, we don't obey Caesar in that point, but we don't go and as authority and meet Caesar with avenging ourselves, you know, like David would, you know, didn't do that, you know, just some. Okay. Right. 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 Yeah. So God first, and you still can be submissive, like I mentioned, not doing that, but one thing that whether you want to say that's not submissive or not, one thing that it's not, if you don't rob the bank, it's not serving authority over the husband or the government. If you don't obey God, you're not serving authority. You're not avenging yourself. You're taking, you're saying, yeah, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whether God delivers us or not, we're still not going to serve you. You know, we're still not going to bow down. You know, so they entrusted themselves to him who judges righteously, just like Jesus did. And that's what we need to do and wives need to do as well. Any other comments?
Sounds like it's probably better to be a Proverbs 31 wife instead of a Proverbs 21.
There you go. I didn't even go to there. We should have went there. There's a lot of stuff we went. So, yeah. Okay, well, we'll pick up in 2 weeks, maybe about the other half.